This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. And also by TrekFan, where you'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Put your love for Trek into action by visiting TrekFan.org and help us move the world one step closer to the Star Trek future. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 110, A Fascinating Conversation. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Matt Ferguson's lithographs from Bye Bye Robot, William Shatner's new album Ponder the Mystery, and Paramount's Into Darkness Blu-ray fiasco. Then in the feature, we're joined by John Tenuto for an in-depth discussion of Khan, from his pre-Space Seed origins to the parallels in Star Trek Into Darkness. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. How are you doing this week?
You know, Chris, doing pretty good. It's Labor Day here in Dallas, Texas tomorrow. Of course, all over the states as well. But, you know,
I was going to say, yeah, only in Dallas. Well, I know you guys in Texas, you know, see yourself as your own country. But come on, I think it's Labor Day for everybody.
Yeah, we do. But it's Labor Day for everyone here in the states. So it's pretty exciting. I love not having to go to work tomorrow. Thinking about most likely just kind of disappearing off the grid for most of the day, just enjoying some time alone, reading, relaxing, that kind of thing. So it's really great. I couldn't be doing better. How about you, Chris?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not Labor Day here. It's a normal day for me, but it was a great weekend. College football kicked off
as we've discussed
on the shows.
My Aggies won, so.
They did. Crimson Tide won, and it was just an exciting weekend of football, so I'm glad it's here. But, you know, now today, I'm ready to talk Star Trek. I got my football on the weekend. Now I'm back into Star Trek mode, and we're going to have a fairly short news segment today because we have a very long feature coming up with John Tenuto. We're going to really, really delve into the character of Khan, both in his original incarnation as well as in the JJ incarnation. But before we do that, Matthew, we do have a few Star Trek news items to talk about. And this first one, I'm really, really thrilled about this. Our friends, Bye Bye Robot, Chris and Charity Wood, they have produced Matt Ferguson's original series lithographs, and I love Matt's artwork, and I am so happy that someone is actually producing it now.
Chris, I couldn't be happier about this either. I mean, this is some good stuff. These were just so beautifully done. In fact, Chris, I can't remember the last time that anybody said anything about Star Trek V, and it made me go, I want that. But the Star Trek V movie poster that he did here is just phenomenal. Bringing out the very best scenes in that film, putting it on the poster, it makes you feel like it's a completely different movie. And each one of these posters in some way really reflects, I think, the spirit and just the beauty of each of these films. And Matt is a fantastic artist, well-deserved. I'm so glad that Bye Bye Robot is bringing these to fans. And, you know, honestly, for $25 a pop or being able to get all six for $125, this is a really great deal. I mean, these would look great on the wall. They're only 12 by 24, so, you know, you could space them out really nicely in a large room. So this is good stuff, and you know how I like my Star Trek artwork. So I don't know. I might just break down and buy that Star Trek V one because whether or not it's the best Star Trek movie, it's a really beautiful poster.
It is a really cool poster. I'm buying them all. I'm buying the whole set of six, and they're going to go up here in the studio because ever since I saw these originally, before they were ever produced, I wanted them on the walls here. And now that Bye Bye Robot has them, I'm absolutely going to get them. They're printed on 100-pound paper. As you said, they're 12 by 24 inches. And again, you can buy them individually, $25 a pop, or get the whole set for $125 plus shipping, and just beautiful work. So congratulations to Matt and Bye Bye Robot for this. And go check them out and order them. And I really wish that, you know, the poster that he did for Into Darkness, which of course is not included in this set, was also really beautiful.
Yes, and it really was.
I was saying on the show here many times that I wish that Paramount would have used his poster for some sort of special edition cover art.
Exactly.
For Into Darkness, which they didn't, but it was really beautiful.
Well, you know, his Generations poster that is out as well is beautiful. It's a wonderful kind of recreation of the poster they did for the movie, but with some beautiful colorization in it. It just looks really, really good. I love the way that he has Shatner and Picard there on the poster, as well as at the bottom having the Nexus and you know, that famous picture of Soren with his arms raised just waiting for the Nexus to take. I mean, it's fantastic poster. And then of course his First Contact poster is so creepy. I mean, really, really creepy. The colorization there with the Borg Queen and everything is really well done. So I'm hoping that they'll turn all of those Next Generation posters in for Bye Bye Robot as well, because these are some great things. You know, if you didn't want to get all 10 or 11, because he's even done Star Trek 09, he's done Into Darkness, so you can get all of them if you wanted. But just being able to pick and choose, I really like that Bye Bye Robot is giving us that opportunity.
Absolutely. So we'll put a link to this in the show notes, and you can hop over to Bye Bye Robot and check these out and grab them. And also another thing, while we're kind of on the creative slant here, Matthew, this is something that somehow it was off my radar. I don't know if I just missed the buildup to it or if no news had leaked out. But William Shatner has a new album coming out very, very soon. U.S. release date, October 8th.
Well, Chris, I know how much you have enjoyed his other albums, such as Has Been or Seeking Major Tom. And so when I saw this the other day, I thought, man, Chris is going to be so excited to see Shatner's got a new album coming out. And so, you know, I haven't listened to a lot of Shatner's work. And so I think I'm going to need to go and peruse some iTunes maybe after we do the show tonight, and just maybe put myself to sleep with some Shatner spoken word soundtrack. It sounds like a good idea. So this one will be coming out, like you said, the October 3rd, and it's really going to be focusing on progressive rock, pop rock kind of thing. So, you know, some special guests on there. We got Vince Gill, Mick Jones. So, you know, you got some good people on here, some great songs. Yeah, I'll be interested at least to hear it for sure.
Right. Now, if you want to listen to some to put yourself to sleep tonight, I do recommend Has Been.
Oh, okay.
Not Seeking Major Tom, because that's got the more soothing tracks on it.
Ah, excellent.
Seeking Major Tom was more like a heavy metal / hard rock type album. You've got Iron Man on there, for example. But not just that. Also some poppy stuff, too. Seeking Major Tom has this really interesting cover of Duran Duran's Planet Earth as the last track.
Ah.
And you just have to hear it. Also, She Blinded Me with Science. Great cover of She Blinded Me with Science. But when I look at this one too, I'm having the same reaction that I had to Seeking Major Tom, which was, I'm not sure if I'm interested in this or not, because it's so different from Has Been. Has Been is just really a brilliant album, and you can really feel, it's very personal for Shatner, the lyrics to the tracks on Has Been. He's really pouring his soul out about his life. And of course, Seeking Major Tom were covers of existing tracks. This one, I'm not sure, you know, prog rock, I don't know how I feel about it. But if I look at who's involved, you know, it's being produced by Billy Sherwood. You already mentioned a lot of the guests there. Rocky Krieger from The Doors is going to be on. And you look at everyone who's on there, and knowing how Seeking Major Tom went from something I wasn't sure about to an album that I really, really love, I'm very optimistic about this one as well. So when this comes out, October 7th for the UK, October 8th for the US and Canada, October 11th for Germany, I'm definitely going to pick it up. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Shatner's done again, because it's almost like he can't miss in anything that he does these days. Everything, no matter what you think about it going in, it just turns out to be great.
Yeah, I mean, he is, you know, I don't know, the quintessential Renaissance man.
Yeah.
So, well done.
So, we'll put a link in the show notes to this if you want to hop over. TrekCore has a good article about it, and they have the track listings and everything. You can see what's going to be on the album. The album is called Ponder the Mystery. And what they say about it is that Shatner is gazing upward at the vast universe, pondering the many facets of conscious existence. So, looking at the agony, the hidden joy of aging, the depths of depression, and the glorious heights found in the beauty and wonderment of life. So, sounds like an inspirational album. Check it out when it comes out. Matthew, last week on The Ready Room, now you weren't with me last week, Daniel Prue was, but we announced a new segment to the show called Questions from the Fleet, and we invited listeners to send in their questions about Star Trek, and then we'll pick a few of them each show and talk about them, answer them on The Ready Room. And we have one this week from Gene Russell from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Gene asks, if you were going to write Star Trek fan fiction, what would you write about? And Gene says that what he would write is, and I think this would be fun, Quantum Trek, where Archer is leaping from life to life within the Star Trek universe, putting right what once went wrong in the writer's room, always hoping that his next leap will be the leap home. And it sounds a little bit like Future Guy, right? Maybe that's what Future Guy in Enterprise was. That was Archer trying to put right what once went wrong. I don't know. I mean, of course, there are many possibilities. If you were going to write Star Trek fan fiction, what would you write about?
You know, I was thinking about this, and the one thing I think that I would want to write is a better death for Kirk. You know, a death that I felt like really meant something. So if there was anything that I feel like I would want to redo and maybe add to the Star Trek canon correct, we should say, would be the death of Kirk. And just, I don't even think the idea for Generations is terrible. Just, I feel like that death scene and what happens there just needs to be rewritten. And so I think that's for me, the thing that I might try to do is just give that captain a better send off.
I think a lot of fans agree with you on that. That's been one of the most talked about topics on The Ready Room, I think, over the course of the past 2.5 years. It seems to come up over and over, you know, that death scene.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of things I would like to write about. Just keeping in the theme of today's show, where we're going to talk about Into Darkness at some points in our future discussion, if I were going to just pick up something that I want to know more about, and I were going to write a story to fill in the gaps, I think I would write about the planet Nibiru and that culture. And what happens to those people after the Enterprise zips off and heads back to Earth? Because it was a great setup for what happens to Kirk in that movie. But I think it's a really important question in Star Trek, and it gets addressed here and there a little bit. Like on TNG, Who Watches the Watchers, for example, kind of addresses that type of thing a bit. But I like to know. They draw the shape of the Enterprise in the dirt. And then, of course, that fades into the actual Enterprise going into space. What happens to those people?
Yeah,
that's where I would go.
That's a good question, Chris. I think that would be a really interesting episode or a story, and even maybe seeing the Enterprise go back and watch them to see what happens might be a really fascinating thing, especially when you think about Kirk having to kind of see the mistake he made and how it's turning out for these people.
Did you just write the story for the next J.J. Star Trek movie? Is it going to be a remake of Who Watches the Watchers?
I think I did. I'm sorry, folks. I didn't mean to spoil the story for you. My bad.
I swear the Mentakans are not in the movie. That's what J.J. will say.
Oh, goodness. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
All right. So, Gene, thank you for sending in your question. And for everyone else, please send your questions to us, things you would like to know about Star Trek, and we will pick some and answer them here on the show. Just go to trek.fm/contact, and you can use the form that's there. There's actually an option now, to whom should I direct this message? If you pull it down, you'll see the Ready Room questions from the fleet. So just choose that and send your questions over to us. And we really appreciate your input on the show. Okay, Matthew, we have one other news item that we're going to talk about today before we jump into this extended feature. This is the big topic that's got everybody in an uproar this week. This is, of course, whether or not Johnny Manziel should have been suspended for more than half a game. Is that right? Is that what we're going to talk about?
Yeah, I thought, Chris, we were going to be talking some sports ball here on the locker room. Wow, be careful because the smell in here is, whew, it's not good, but welcome to the locker room.
You don't even want to go to the other side of the locker room.
Oh, it's the worst. But yeah, welcome to the locker room here with Christopher Jones. I'm Matthew Rushing, and we'll be talking sports ball all the time. Oh, wait, no. Chris, we're going to be talking about the biggest blunder I may have ever seen in marketing, and that is by Paramount with the brand new Blu-ray problem that Into Darkness has, and the fact that apparently... Yeah. The extras have been scattered to the four winds of the galaxy, the four quadrants of the galaxy. In fact, 5, 6, 7, 8 galaxies, apparently, because you will have to buy this film a billion times if you would like to have all the extras.
Yeah, this is insane. And to be accurate here, I added up that you would need to buy the movie 5 times, I believe, because they have given content to Target, to Best Buy, to iTunes, to Cinema Now, and Vudu. And I started to say I don't know what they're thinking, but you know, we were talking about this on Twitter, and our friend Jose Munoz, who of course worked on Star Trek and worked at Paramount, I believe it was, or CBS, I think it was Paramount because he was working on it back in those days. But at any rate, Jose, I mean, he said, what he said is exactly true. He said that we, the fans, are not the customers. Because I said Paramount's gone and, you know, they don't care about their customers. And he said, well, we're not the customers. Their customers are Target and Best Buy and Apple. And he's true. It's true. What he's saying is accurate, unfortunately. They're looking at how can they make their retailers happy, not how they can make the fans happy. And so what they've done is they have created rather extensive amounts of extras for Star Trek Into Darkness. But instead of just putting them all on the Blu-ray, which is what has been done in the past and what they should be doing, they have taken like a core bit of features and put those on all the discs. And then they've given bits and pieces here and there to different retailers. And if you want everything and you live in the United States, the only way to get it is to actually buy every different release of the film.
And Chris, what I don't understand about this, and I've said this a couple of times now, we were talking to, I don't think we were talking about this on iMessage or something, and I believe it was. And, you know, The Lord of the Rings extended versions, to me, are the pinnacle of what it means to have extras on a disc. And we're talking hours and hours, like 2 hours of extras, just the best documentaries I've ever seen about a film being made. Fans love this kind of stuff. And I don't understand, you know, Jose may be correct in that we might not be the base or what they're going after, but it doesn't make any sense when we're the ones buying the film. And so,
right.
And in fact, fanboys are the ones who are going to be buying this film. And so give us all the extras that you can, and we will just eat it up because we will, that's what we love. We love having all the background information. That's why I love having, again, the extras on the Lord of the Rings extended Blu-rays, because they're just so fantastic. And I didn't even buy The Hobbit.
I'm going on an adventure!
When it came out on Blu-ray, because I knew they were going to do an extended version, and it would continue that with the appendices that they had been doing in the original Lord of the Rings. And so I just don't understand any of the logic here for Paramount. Even if you're trying to make your retailers happy, Chris, this doesn't make any sense because it's not even about the retailers. It's about the people who buy the film, because nobody buys the film from the retailers if they're not getting what they want. And so Paramount has a problem here, right? Because people might just not buy this film, and maybe they shouldn't.
Well, okay, so my case, as soon as Into Darkness was announced for pre-order, I pre-ordered it from Amazon, and I pre-ordered the highest level edition, other than, of course, the one that you pre-ordered that has the phaser that comes with it. And that's what I always buy, because I know those releases are going to have everything on them, and I want to have everything. When I found out about this, I canceled my order. And so I'm going to wait for the Japanese release on Blu-ray, because the Japanese Blu-ray will have everything on it, because we don't yet, thankfully, have this ridiculous approach to marketing in Japan where you start actually messing with the content to appease retailers, where you start just scattering stuff around everywhere. So what I did, because I need to be able to reference the movie and I wanted to hear the commentary, which, as part of this, is apparently only available in the iTunes release. So if you buy this Blu-ray, there's no commentary track. From everything that we've been able to gather so far, it's an iTunes exclusive. Now, what kind of movie is released without a commentary track these days?
I don't know, Chris. Those movies where they don't do one at all?
Right. And so what I did is I got the iTunes copy, because I figured that I need it, because I published Trek FM and we talk about these things, and the Japanese Blu-ray won't come out until probably at the earliest December, because the movie just opened here last Friday, and it could be even longer than that. But in terms of Blu-ray, I'm just going to wait, because I'm not going to buy 5 copies of this movie in order to get all of the material. And what's really sad about the commentary is what they did is actually kind of cool. They call it an enhanced commentary, and it runs 2 hours and 42 minutes, which of course is quite a bit, about more than half an hour longer than the film. And the reason it runs that way is that they freeze the movie, they rewind sometimes as they're discussing things, they do inset boxes where they show, you know, like how it looked on the set when they were shooting it versus how it looks on the final production with the special effects put into place. It's really an interesting thing, and they keep bringing different people in over the course of this. So you don't have the same people all the way through. They bring people in to talk about the photography, about the writing, about the, you know, costume set, everything. It's very interesting, and it's really a crime that they're not putting it on the Blu-rays for everybody.
Yeah, Chris, I'm still obviously getting the Blu-ray. We talked about this before we started on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
With John before we got to record with him. And I thought about this, and sometimes when you get a Blu-ray and it comes with a digital copy, the extras will come with the digital copy. There are quite a few films that I looked at. In fact, recently I just got Jurassic Park on Blu-ray because it came out for the 20th anniversary. They had put it back out in films in 3D, and it looked so good. So I wanted it on Blu-ray, and it came with the digital copy, and I got the extras there. And so I'm really hoping that with the Into Darkness Blu-ray, it does come with a iTunes digital copy. And so I'm really hoping that I will also get those extras that you have with it, and I won't be missing out on that commentary. For me, that's the only way that this makes sense, that you get the Blu-ray and you actually do end up with this commentary. Otherwise, I feel like this is just a complete disservice. The other extras that they gave to, say, Target or whatever, that's okay to give them an extra 30 minutes or whatever, but give me the stinking commentary so that I can watch it through with the film. And of course, you know, I'm going to have to find a way to get my, you know, computer hooked up to my TV so I can watch the enhanced commentary, or just buy an Apple TV maybe finally.
Apple TV is awesome.
But yeah, so I'm disappointed in Paramount, I guess. I just think this is a cheap, ridiculous ploy that they should not be doing to their fans.
Right. Well, I hope you're right about the digital copy downloading the extras. Now, when I downloaded it, I got a 5 gigabyte file for the feature film and a 5.6 gigabyte file for the extras. So they were separate files. And then in iTunes, if you just click the movie, it'll just play the film. And you have to click this little spot that says play iTunes extras. And then it takes you into a menu that looks like what you're accustomed to on a DVD, where you can actually see the different features and you can watch the enhanced commentary. We should also say that we're really beating up on Paramount here, Paramount marketing. They also say Bad Robot reportedly controls the bonus content. And so this may also be part of Bad Robot who's coming in and telling Paramount, I don't know what the relationship is. I don't know, you know, what kind, who can dictate terms to whom here. But knowing how JJ has handled things, even going back to Lost, and how he typically handles marketing and promotion of shows and such through Bad Robot, it wouldn't surprise me if Bad Robot is also responsible for the way this is being split up. Again, I'm not saying they are. I don't have any information one way or the other. But reportedly, they retain control over the rights to the bonus content. And so it may be part Paramount, part Bad Robot here. Whoever's responsible, though, this is really not right. And I think that fans... My position is, if I weren't doing Trek FM, I would just simply not buy Star Trek Into Darkness at all. It would be, and I buy everything Star Trek that comes out, because CBS does such a brilliant job of giving us meaningful extras content. I would just not buy it, because my fear is that this is kind of the new marketing thing. And I'm sure that on paper, this looked great. And they were sitting there at Paramount Marketing and they thought, oh, this is going to be awesome. We're going to give some content here, and everyone's going to be so happy. All the retailers are going to love it. And they didn't give any thought to the fans. And if we accept this as fans, it's going to happen on the next movie, not just the Star Trek movie, but, you know, World War Z or whatever the next movie is that comes out. And it's going to keep happening, and it's going to become the norm, and it's going to reach a point where you're never going to be able to get your hands on all the bonus material that's created for something that you want to see. And that's just not the way it should be. I don't care if the retailers are the customers, and I agree with what Jose said there. He's right from a business standpoint, and he doesn't agree with that either. He's just saying that's the reality. But at the end of the day, you know, we, the fans, we're the ones who support these franchises. We're the ones who make it possible for these movies to keep being made, because we're the ones who go to the box office and spend the money and buy the tickets and buy the Blu-rays. And we really cannot allow the studios to start ignoring the desires of the fans to the point where we now, you know, it's going to cost you what, like $250 or whatever, if you want to know behind the scenes about what happened in the movie.
Yeah. You know what, Chris? I already spent enough on this film in the theater. And so I'm just going to buy one copy of the Blu-ray so that I have the film. Hopefully it'll come with that digital copy that has the extras. If not, you know what? I'm not going to worry about it. So you're not getting any more of my money.
And what they should do to make amends to the fans here, at a bare minimum, is this commentary track should be made available for anyone who has purchased any version of the Blu-ray.
Yes, exactly.
It should be available as downloadable content for free. So those are our thoughts on it. You know, it's been a big topic this week. People have been talking about it all over Twitter, all over the websites. TrekCore did a lot of homework. That's where we got a lot of our information. TrekCore did a great job. Go over to their website and read what they've written. And yeah, you know, it's just been the big topic. So we had to speak up about it, share our thoughts. People have been asking us what we thought about it. And that's what we think about it. All right, Matthew. Well, it's time to pep things back up again on a positive note, and we're going to jump into this very long extended feature with John Tenuto and talk about Khan. But before we do that, we need to tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, and that is Squarespace. Your support of Squarespace is very important to us. It makes it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. And let us tell you a little bit about why they are the best choice of web hosting and CMS that you'll find anywhere on the internet. It's a really great platform, an all-in-one platform, and it makes it really simple for you to create your own space online. That could be a blog, a website, a portfolio, an online store. Really, anything that you can imagine, you can do it very easily there. I've been using Squarespace for 6 years. I love them. Trek FM is built on Squarespace, and apart from the fact that the tools are just really awesome, they're constantly improving the platform with new features and new designs, and even better support. And amazingly, you get all of this for just $8 a month. That's the starting price. And if you choose the annual plan, you can get a free custom domain registration as well. Matthew, why don't you tell everyone about 3 points about Squarespace that really show why it is the platform to choose when you want to create an online presence?
Well, Chris, I think one that's really important to me is that Squarespace is design focused. I don't know about you, but I really hate going to a website that everything is so cluttered. It's hard for me to be able to find anything. It's so overdone that I'm really missing, I think, what the website's meant to do, which is to give me whoever's doing this website their content. And Squarespace really helps you do that. Their templates are extremely clean, and they allow your content to take the focus of the website, which is so important. I mean, you know, if you're writing a blog or you're creating a store and showcasing your work, you really want that to be what stands out, not the website itself. And Squarespace does that really well. And then, of course, if you're creating, say, a blog or some sort of store where you're selling your merchandise or any of those kind of things, you're going to want to be able to connect your site to all the different accounts that are out there, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, all of these social network sites that really help you to be able to get your content out there. Squarespace makes that easy. You don't have to worry about that. It helps you link to all those accounts and be able to share very quickly what you're doing on your blog right away with your followers. And then for the most important thing, I think, now these days, Chris, is that, you know, you have an iPad, I have an iPad, we both have iPhones. We tend to look up websites on those. Nothing is more frustrating than going to a website and having to try and navigate on especially your iPhone or your mobile device and not having the website be responsive to the mobile design, but also have it be a smart mobile design so it doesn't feel watered down. It just feels like a better, easier to use website on your device. Squarespace does that perfectly. It has unique mobile design so that your site automatically scales to look beautiful on every device.
And also they've introduced a couple of additional things that will be useful for you, not only for commerce, but for personal sites as well. They've introduced a donations block, so you can very easily accept donations now. And they also have new product integrations as well and service product types, which means that, you know, in addition to physical or digital products, you now have a type for services as well. So don't take our word for it. Try it for yourself for free. Go to squarespace.com. You can get a free 14-day trial. There's no credit card required. Just enter your name and email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your website. And if you already use a platform like WordPress, you can import your current site and see how the Squarespace tools give you everything you need to create an exceptional website. Then when you sign up, and I know you're going to want to, use our offer code TREK9 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. So support us and support Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com, use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. And we thank Squarespace for their support and you for supporting Squarespace. And that helps us bring this programming to you every week. Matthew, today we're going to do something a little bit different on the Ready Room. Instead of discussing an episode, we're going to discuss a character. And this character is arguably the most iconic villain in Star Trek history, and indeed cinema history. He's a character of superior abilities who easily grows fatigued. So, of course, I'm talking about Khan Noonien Singh.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Q. Oh, dang it.
Q doesn't grow fatigued as easily.
No, you're talking about Anorax, right?
Oh, yeah, he grows fatigued.
Yeah.
And, of course, any discussion of Khan would not be complete without our friend John Tenuto. So, John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, guys.
So, John, I think, you know, you have talked about Khan on the Ready Room before, and of course, you've joined Matthew and me to talk about other things on various shows. I think you know more about Khan and Ricardo Montalban than anyone on the planet. I'm not sure if you are a Cumberbatcher yet, though.
No, I'm not. You know, I know I know the Khan Cumberbatch, I think, pretty well, but I don't know as much about, anywhere near as much about Cumberbatch, the actor or person, as I know about Ricardo Montalban, the man and the person. So if there's four areas there, you know, Khan, Montalban, Khan, and Montalban, and then Khan, Cumberbatch, and Cumberbatch, I'm missing that 25% of the Cumberbatch actor, except, of course, appreciating his work on Sherlock and, you know, appreciating his talent as an actor. But in terms of him as a person and what that might connect with Khan, that's something that will be interesting for us to look at.
Yeah. So we want to talk about some various aspects of Khan today. We want to talk about Khan both in The Wrath of Khan or Space Seed / The Wrath of Khan and Khan in Into Darkness and, you know, how the character is used and such. And John, we've talked about this on a previous Ready Room in depth, so people can go over and check that one out. We'll put a link in the show notes to it for the really, really deep information. But I thought it would be nice for those who haven't heard that, and just to kick off the discussion here, for you to give a little bit of background about the origins of Khan, the character, as the character was created prior to the casting of Ricardo Montalban and the filming of Space Seed. Because, a lot of people were really upset about Khan being Into Darkness and him not being Indian, not being a Sikh. But, of course, the origins of the character, I think, for me anyway, kind of make that okay in my eyes. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, the very first, kind of do a quick summary, the very first mention of the character who would become Khan was in an August 29th, 1966, 18-page story outline called Space Seed, though, by Carrie Wilbur, who is a journalist and television screenplay author. And he had created this character named Harold Erickson. And in that outline, there were the very broad strokes of the Space Seed that we know. There was an argosy called the Botany Bay that had lifted off from Earth as part of the background of what would sort of lay the foundations for the story, and that ship of prisoners was found by Kirk, and they were unfrozen. But Harold Erickson was a really different character. Harold Erickson he wasn't genetically engineered. He was a little bit stronger, but more because he was really a barbarian in a way, not because of anything in terms of his genetic makeup. And he was presented more as either an Aryan. The description is Viking like, but they play it more for this sort of Aryan, blonde haired, blue eyed kind of thing. And he really spends the whole story in the brig, which is kind of interesting because there's a little connection there with Star Trek Into Darkness, and like escaping from the brig. And he would escape, and no one would know he would escape. And his mission really was to kind of kill one of the crew of the Botany Bay who could reveal who he really was and that these people were really criminals, and they wanted to keep that hidden from Kirk because the idea was to steal the Enterprise and then become pirates. And that was sort of the broad stroke of that outline. And Spock was very different. He cheats at chess, and there's a lot of fun differences there. And Wilbur, of course, had never seen Star Trek because he's writing this before it's ever aired, you know, about a week or so before it airs for the first time. And, you know, there's these memos that go back and forth. And the focus really is on making the story workable from a budget point of view, from the memos by Robert Justman. But the really interesting memos to me are the ones by Gene Kuhn. And I think the most important of these memos is a September 9th memo, 1966, where Kuhn basically lays down a challenge to Cary Wilbur to create Erickson as Kirk's equal, to really beef this character up, to change him. I think without saying it, him, he's basically saying create the Joker of Star Trek, you know, create an equal for Kirk, a really interesting challenge for Kirk. And then it goes through all these different permutations. Eventually, it'll be a mixture of Cary Wilbur, Gene Kuhn, and Gene Roddenberry. Gene Roddenberry kind of comes in at the very, very end, and he adds a lot of what we know as Khan. And really, the two big things that produce the Khan that we know is Gene Roddenberry's draft of the script, and then the casting by Joe DiAgusta of Ricardo Montalban. And when Montalban is cast, at that time, it's still a character named John Erickson at that point. And they change the character to fit Ricardo Montalban. They make him, they sort of take away that Aryan element and make him an Indian Sikh. And there's, you know, a lot of interesting memos about name choice and where the name Khan is supposed to be in the name because he's supposed to be a Sikh. But that's all changed because of the casting of Ricardo Montalban. Right. So again, that kind of plays into Star Trek Into Darkness, where they kind of mess with the ethnicity a little bit of the character because of the casting of the actor.
Mm-hmm. And I heard or read somewhere that they actually, I thought they said they shot, although I don't know how that would work, but the Into Darkness script, they were actually using the name Erickson, and then they decided that it would be too much of a giveaway, and so they went with Harrison.
Yeah, my understanding is it starts off as Robert April as the name of the character.
Well, he's in the comics. Yeah, they use
right,
April.
But that was this is like their early drafts, which
even
is why
before that. Okay.
If you remember, there was a reporter who had seen like things labeled Robert April's phaser, okay, things like that, and then they went on and tweeted they weren't supposed to do that, I guess, or they're supposed to wait, and they went on and tweeted, you know, about Robert April or whatever. So my understanding is they're originally going to name the character Robert April, and then they withdrew that because I think they realized too many people would kind of would know what that reference was to. And then there was the name Erickson, and then they changed it to Harrison. But, you know, John Harrison and John Erickson are pretty close to
right.
You know.
Yeah, they don't think that really fooled anyone.
No. There was just too much. The casting calls that they had put out, the fact that it was Benicio del Toro, really until 2 or 3 weeks or so before they started filming, whatever happened there where that deal fell through, the fact that they were looking at Hispanic or Latino actors to kind of, I mean, it all pointed. The fact that they said it was going to be, basically said it was Khan at the end of 2009, that they were going to put that tag on, where they were going to have the Botany Bay. I mean, there was so much that you really would have had to have and really, and I always contended, you don't name any villain of a Hollywood movie such a bland name as John Harrison.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely so.
Might as well have been John Doe.
Yeah.
Well, the thing, too, is that there were so many clues in the film as well, like even before you know who he is. I mean, just when they say there are 72 torpedoes, it's like if you're a Star Trek fan, if you are really an original series Star Trek fan, you know what that is, especially with what's already taking place. So, okay, well, that's the background in a nutshell. And of course, as I said, we had you and Larry on together about, I don't know, 6 months or 8 months ago or something to talk about the road to the Wrath of Khan, and you go into much greater depth about this whole history of the character there. So everyone go check that out if you're interested. I'll put a link in the show notes. Let's jump into the use of Khan now. And Matthew, your impressions of Khan, I will just go ahead and say, I don't know how you guys feel. I know how Matthew feels. I'm not sure about you, John. I didn't mind them using Khan in Into Darkness as a character, if they were going to do something new with him. So, Matthew, what were your just basic feelings about Khan? And we'll discuss in depth as we go along.
You know, when I first saw the movie, and of course, you know, it was obviously revealed that it was going to be him, I saw where they went with the character. I came out the first time thinking that they had used the character differently enough that I didn't feel like I was just watching the Khan character that I'd seen before. Like, this is a very different Khan. And so just as the characterization, who he was, what he was about, some of that was the same, but also some of it was very different. And his storyline, some of it was kind of the same, but a lot of it was completely different. And so, like you, Chris, I didn't have a problem with them using Khan again, you know, because you're able to do that when you jump into an alternate universe, the same way they do with the Mirror Universe, where they use everybody and then just tell a completely different story with them. So I didn't really have a problem with that. I just needed them to tell me what I thought would be a good story. And in the end, I enjoyed the story that they did tell me. I thought it was a good story. And so I didn't really have a problem with who they chose to portray Khan as, what they chose to portray him as, that in this universe, things were a little bit different. Even though when you go back and kind of think about when the timeline changed, Khan shouldn't be any different at all. But, you know, it's a fictional universe. I just let all that stuff go. The characterization, the casting, everything for me, I felt like really worked. And I liked that this Khan was different. I liked that he was a little bit more, I felt like he was even more sadistic and really scary. I felt like for the first time I was really scared of Khan. As much as I love Multipon's Khan, he's not scary to me in the same way that this Khan is. I could be completely different than either of you guys on that, which I probably am. But this Khan, I just felt like, oh my gosh, this guy is insane. And compared to the other Khan, where I never really got, I guess comparing the two, this guy's just a lot scarier to me.
Right. And John, I'm interested in your thoughts in the same way, because you have such an intimate connection to Montalban's Khan and you've studied it in such depth. What did you think about the use of Khan?
Well, you know, I mean, I thought there was inevitability. I think we're all pretty aware of how Hollywood works. A second movie tends to have, I don't know if that's a Superman 2 created that, or Empire Strikes Back or something, where there was so much emphasis and deepening and richness of Vader's character in Empire Strikes Back. But the whole idea that the second film in a trilogy or a franchise, you know, sort of uses the big bad guy. So we've seen so many examples, Batman, everything. And I think it would have been no surprise to most people that they would have thought of using the character. I'm very happy, from a logic point of view, Matt is absolutely right. You know, that this Khan should be physically the same, ethnically the same, because the changes that occurred, way after he's born and sent into space. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think I was very glad they didn't try to mimic Ricardo Montalban, because I think that would have been a mistake. Right. I think they, one thing that, I think that there's a lot of things I don't like about what J.J. Abrams has done to Star Trek. One is, I think he's so obsessed with the surprises, and frankly, the surprises are never surprises. And I think that actually harms Star Trek. I think they could have made another $50 million if they had put Khan in the advertising for this film before it was out. Mm-hmm. Because my mother knows who Khan is. My mother knows who Khan is, and she's 80. And everybody knows who Khan is, and I think it would have brought more people to the theater.
Well, let me ask you, because one thing that bothers me about this is not the fact that they used Khan, and I do agree with what you guys are saying, that I'm glad that they didn't try to mimic Ricardo Montalban. I'm glad that Khan actually is very different, because I can dismiss that, you know, in my mind. He doesn't have to look like Ricardo Montalban for it to be Khan for me. And the story works better by him not being like Ricardo Montalban, because if he is, then you're really fixated the entire time on the fact that they're trying to just mimic something. But the thing is that what bothers me most of all is that they lied to everyone for so long that it's not Khan. And even after everyone had figured it out, like, it's not Khan. I swear, this isn't going to be like The Wrath of Khan. This isn't Khan. And then it is. And I'm thinking that, you know, people are going to find out in a few months when the movie opens in the theater. And it's great to surprise people. But if you have to actually lie about something that everyone has already figured out in order to surprise them, as you said, John, it's not a surprise anymore. And I feel like the reason that they denied it to the bitter end is that they were afraid, and I could be totally wrong, it's just my opinion, they were afraid that there would be a backlash from inside the Star Trek fan base. If fans knew going in that it was Khan, they would simply not go see the movie. Now, maybe the general audience would have gone out and seen it, and maybe they would have made an extra $50 million that way. But I feel like there are a lot of Star Trek fans who came out of the movie hating it, who would have simply never gone at all if they had known for certain in advance that it was Khan.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think, you know, I also think a big part of it is that obsession with unnecessary obsession with secrecy. I mean, I do agree. I do believe that, you know, the trailers spoil a lot, that, you know, you really, you know, but the reality is, if you don't want to be spoiled, you cannot be spoiled. You know, I or if you want to be spoiled, you can be. I mean, it depends on how much you want to go on the internet. You know, it's a choice. But you know, I've never been surprised at a Star Trek film. I mean, I wasn't surprised Vulcan exploded in the first film, because they did show that in the trailer. I mean, there's a planet that exploded. You knew there was a threat about Vulcan. You presumed that wasn't Earth. I mean, none of these, I mean, there was nothing in one, maybe the death of Amanda, but nothing that was truly surprising in that film. And I felt the same way in this film too, that there really wasn't anything that was surprising enough to go through exactly what you said, which I think is really a denigration of fans. You know, I don't want to go so far as to say they owe fans an apology, but, you know, lying isn't okay. I'm not in the post-Clinton world where it's okay under certain circumstances. It's not okay. And you know, it's not, especially not okay for something like this. It's not national security here. It's a film. All you needed to do was say, to tell people during interviews, to tell the actors during interviews, just say, I can't comment. That's going to be a surprise in the film. Who, you know,
right.
We don't want to spoil the film. Just say we don't want to spoil the film. And that's it. You don't need to make people lie or do these, like, very careful, I'm playing someone named John Harrison. Well, are you playing Khan? I think someone even asked, at any point, is your character named Khan? It was like, I'm playing, I mean, it was like listening to a political, you know,
right.
Debate yeah. or something. That's unsavory. I mean, it doesn't bode well when you do that. And, you know, the average person doesn't pay that much close attention to it, but mm-hmm. I don't think Gene Roddenberry ever lied to me to keep a secret. I'm pretty sure George Lucas hasn't. You know, I know Nicholas Meyer didn't. And they were able to keep secrets too. And I don't, you know, I think it just, it may not, maybe they're just not clever enough to keep a secret, or maybe it's impossible in the modern era to keep a secret, and they either need to embrace that impossibility
yeah.
or just come up with a plan that says, this is what you tell people.
So, you know, my wife went to watch Into Darkness with me. She's not a big Trekkie, but she knows some Next Generation and, of course, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, some Enterprise. And she generally will not watch the original series because it's just too old for her. She's just not interested in it. So after seeing Into Darkness this weekend, we watched Space Seed and we watched The Wrath of Khan. And as I explained afterwards, you're talking about, like, how do you handle a situation like this? We all know that before The Wrath of Khan, it leaked out in the pre-internet age that Spock dies in the movie. And fans couldn't believe that Spock dies in the movie. So what do? They have Spock die in the Kobayashi Maru simulator scene, you know, die with air quotes at the beginning of the movie. So everyone forgets about it. Everyone's, oh, Spock died, but he didn't really die. Okay, cool. I'm going to watch the rest of the movie now. So that when he actually does die at the end, it's a surprise. You know, that's how you handle something like that instead of just flat out lying about it.
Yeah, and I'm with you in that. I just don't think that you have to lie at all. All you need to do is do it what John just said. You just need to say, we're not going to comment on the villain in this movie. The reason we're not going to comment is because we want it to be a surprise for you when you go to see the movie. And this is the digital age. I know you all want to know who the villain is. But you know what? We're just we just want you to enjoy the film. And that's all you need to say. You don't even need to tell people that his name is John freaking Harrison. Just let people enjoy the movie. And I don't understand, you know, because at that point, it's not really secretive. It's just kind of stupid. And it, I feel like in some ways you're kind of making the audience stupid, or at least you're making them feel stupid.
Insulting and the audience. Yes.
That's just not appropriate. Yeah, exactly. Right. And you know, Trek fans don't want to be insulted.
It created story convolutions that were unnecessary. So I'm still not clear after watching that film whether Kirk, who really should know, especially being a repeat offender genius, as he's been labeled. You know, if this was, you know, to use the prototype or the archetype, if that was Hitler and the guy says, my name is Hitler, you would have a reaction to that. But because they had to do this convolution, and Kirk should have had a reaction to that being Khan. And when he says the name Khan, that should mean, he didn't say my name is Noonien, you know, he said Khan, and you would at least have a thing in your mind going, oh, genetically enhanced Khan, this has got to be the Khan, you know, the one who controlled a third of the world. I learned about that in my history books. I mean, but because of the secrecy thing and, you know, I understand that they didn't want to have to get into that in the film, slow the film down or whatever, but the John Harrison storyline added a complication. Then I wonder if it took the story in certain directions it wouldn't have needed to go. That could have tightened the story better if they just didn't bother with the secrecy thing. Why did they even have to name this guy? They could have just said, this is a rogue agent, we don't know who this guy is, or who is this guy, and, you know, you know, this guy did it, here's the photos, this is where we think he's at. You know, I mean, they could have done the whole thing without the name.
Yeah. I think that you could do it like that, but I think story-wise that Marcus has given him the name John Harrison to completely cover up who he is so that nobody would question that he's not
I think so.
From this time period. I think that's probably the main reason, John. And so...
Yeah, that's in the novel. That's a great scene in the novel.
Yeah. You know, I don't really think there's any problem with all of that. I just, again, you don't need to, before the film, say, this is John Harrison, this is Khan. You just need to say, the villain is a surprise for you guys. Enjoy the film.
Okay, so Marcus and Harrison, this leads to the next topic that I want to discuss, and to move on beyond the... just the issue of the fact that they're using him in the first place and that they covered it up. This is especially, okay, so Into Darkness, I've seen it several times now, and it frustrates, each time I watch it, it frustrates me more and more. And the reason is that, but despite the fact that they're using Khan, I feel like they actually created a really interesting story. And the movie works for me for about 2/3 of the movie. And I particularly like the idea that Khan is associated with Section 31 because they're taking an element from modern Star Trek and they're working it back in time to the TOS era, and it works. And, you know, it takes some of that realism, some of that grayness of life that I know Matthew and I both love about Deep Space Nine, and they're putting it into the original series setting. And I think that's wonderful. And the fact that John Harrison is Khan, like I'm not focused on the fact that he's Khan. And I mean, going into the movie, I knew he was Khan, but I'm not really caring about that as I'm watching through the first 2/3 of this movie. the idea that the Botany Bay was discovered by Starfleet, the Khan and his followers, you know, they were brought back in. Khan was woken up, but it all happened by someone else, not the Enterprise, is fine with me. And I actually like that because it shows that events in this timeline are different, a little bit different. And the idea that the head of Starfleet, as Admiral Marcus, would have some sort of behind-the-scenes scheme going on, and he would be using someone like Khan to further an agenda, I think is very cool. What did you guys think about Khan being involved with Section 31?
I thought it was a great addition to the character. I thought this film, part of it may have been sort of when it came out, kind of close to the Boston terrorist attack.
Right, yeah.
You know, sort of reminding everyone about the world as it is. And, you know, this Star Trek film does do what Star Trek should do, which it has a heart to it, both a heart in terms of the characters and the way they relate to one another and so on, but also it has a social imagination to it. It says something, you know, that speech that Kirk gives at the end isn't just at the end of the film. I mean, really, that theme really is woven into that whole story of Kirk having to make the decision of whether or not to fire the torpedoes, if that's the right thing to do. You know, at what point do we let our own vengeance, overtake our rule of law and our morality and the heart of who we are as a people? And I think that, you know, that's a very important message. It's a very important topic. It's Star Trek doing, I mean, this is as much as Star Trek VI was sort of right at the right time, you know, right, with what was going on in world events, this is too, I think. And especially, you know, in how the war on terrorism has morphed and changed. And I thought that was a really great idea. And I think bringing in Section 31 adds a dimension to Khan, makes Star Trek, this feel like it's part of the Star Trek universe, as a nod to Enterprise, where there was Section 31 in that show as well. And I think that it's a great, it adds a dimension to him. I wish they would have added more to Marcus. I mean, I think he's kind of a comic book villain. They needed to give him more, flesh him out a little bit more, to make it more than just like, oh, the Klingons have attacked two worlds, so therefore it justifies. They should have added something. I mean, did he lose his wife? Is that how his wife died? You know, something. Mm-hmm. Which would have been an interesting, weird riff off of The Wrath of Khan, right? So make Marcus lose his wife, and he's the one who, you know, who's seeking vengeance. I mean, so in some ways, Khan becomes the puppet in this film, manipulated by Marcus, who's manipulated everybody. And so I think they should have spent more time with Marcus, more screen time. I mean, he was great, Peter Weller was great in the role, but I thought that they needed to, you know, I would have seen a little bit, maybe they could have toned down some of the action scenes or let it go another 10 minutes or something and added some more dimension. Because I really thought both Marcuses weren't given what they should have been given. And in that, Section 31 isn't given as much as it should have been given to sort of beef up the story a little bit more.
Yeah, I think tone down some of the action scenes. Because another thing I found interesting is that my teenage son came out of the movie and said that there are too many fight scenes in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's just a little bit too much. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't Man of Steel.
I think that what I love about them using Section 31 and Marcus and Khan is that for the longest time, you're not really sure who the bad guy is. And
right.
So I thought that was really smart, because you're kind of wondering, okay, is it Marcus? Is it really Khan? What is going on? I liked the ambiguity of who really is the bad guy. Is it a guy that's inside? Is it Marcus? Is it somebody on the top who's pulled the wool over everybody's eyes and using this for his own vendetta and or just belief system? Which is interesting, because Peter Weller is really playing the character that he plays in Enterprise and those Terra Prime episodes, and Demon. So it's very much the same type of character. and very much in line with what we see today, and obviously a riff off of George W. Bush, because he speaks with the wonderful Southern accent and calls him boy all the time. So, son. So, I mean, they're doing a lot of things in that, and I think it's really smart, and I like what they are doing. I agree with John. The novelization does a wonderful job of adding some more dialogue to some very key scenes, specifically the scene where Marcus is talking to Kirk in his office with Spock about what their mission is going to be and why. I think that could have been added to. There are a couple of scenes with Carol Marcus that could have been added to as well from the novelization, just allowing just a little bit more dialogue. And so 10 minutes, seriously, JJ, you can add 10 freaking minutes to a movie, and guess what? We're fanboys. We'll sit through it. In fact, the world all went and saw The Return of the King. It has 7 endings. We can handle it. So, you know, all of those things I think could have been even more expounded on and made even better just by adding, you know, just a little bit more dialogue to some scenes, and you would have been fine. I don't have a problem with the action. I think the action's fantastic. JJ choreographs action very well, and he actually tells story through action very well if you're paying attention. But I do think the film itself could have added a little more dialogue, and what it could have done for the film is really flushed out that Section 31 Marcus Khan relationship that I think was really key to the film, to really making this a different Khan than we had seen before, and helping me be okay with the fact that Khan was in the movie in the first place.
Yeah. Well, hey, shorten the space jump a little bit and get rid of the ridiculous scene where Spock calls old Spock, and use that for the scenes that you're talking about right here. That would have made things better.
When you were talking about the son, him calling him son, I thought that was a great, you know, there's a couple of things that really need to be admired in the film. And one of them is the dialogue. I think, you know, you could have put Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly in their prime in this film, and we would have felt they were speaking in the voice of those characters. I mean, so the casting, they know how to cast, and that these actors are fantastic. But I think the dialogue is really good, and the use of that word son I thought was brilliant, because Kirk really has that choice. Which father is he going to follow? You know, he's got three fathers,
exactly,
which to choose from. Does he follow his own father, whose voice is heard in the film? Does he follow his adopted father, you know, in Pike? Or does he follow this potential new father, who is Marcus? And I thought that Marcus calling him son, because I believe, doesn't Pike also call him son, doesn't he? I believe he does. So. Mm-hmm. And if not, certainly that vibe is there, you know. And I thought that was just really great. I mean, I thought it, a little bit more dialogue, however they needed to do that, I would have loved, because the dialogue is a dance too. I mean, that's action too. If it's written well, it's an action scene of words. And I think that, you know, like when they're just bantering back and forth with each other, it sounded so true to who these characters were. And I thought, a little more of that, a little more background to Marcus, to both Marcuses, a little bit more about Section 31, and maybe even a little bit more about Khan. I mean, they certainly gave him at least a little more time to share his backstory, but a little more about his backstory would have been good. Even throw in a line like, because I'm presuming that the Khan that was defrosted was Montalban Khan, and that they used, you know, whatever surgical techniques they have in the future, hide his name and also hide his physicality. Because, I mean, you would, if you saw Hitler, you would go, that's Adolf Hitler, right? So you would look at Khan and go, that's Khan, even though his name is John Harris. Like, look at him. Because every schoolboy should know, and schoolgirl should know that person. Right. So I presume that the reason he looks like, you know, Sherlock Holmes is because they did radical surgery on him. I mean, that's what I'm presuming.
That is a fantastic point, John. I think that you are thinking more deeply and more logically than Orsi Kurtzman and Lindelof on this, because I really doubt that that ever crossed their minds based on their general writing.
Well, you know,
but that's a fantastic point.
I don't know if that's the case. I mean, obviously they wanted Benicio del Toro for this film, and that's where they were going with it. And he, that deal fell through, and then they got Benedict. And so I don't know if necessarily this had so much to do with them not thinking of it. I think it just, the actor that they ended up with just didn't fit Montalban's con. And so we're just meant to go with,
right,
the fact that, yes, this is a different universe. He looks different. Just let it go.
I think you're right. But you know, but if you think about good, if really thinking about the writing, thinking about the concept, like if you're going to do this, I think what John explains, that really makes sense. If you think about the whole storyline, well, Marcus wanted to conceal Khan's identity and all. Yes, John, what you're saying, that's what you would do, right? But instead, they were trying to cast someone who could pass for Khan as Montalban's Khan, and then they kind of ended up with this because they weren't able to cast who they wanted.
You know, it's funny. I asked Joe DiAgosto, who was the casting director on Star Trek, so did Mission Impossible. He cast the Brady Bunch. I mean, it was just wonderful. It was such a thrill and honor to talk to him. And I did ask him, though, what would have made you think? Because the description of the character of Harold Erickson / John Erickson at the time that he was casting was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, Viking-like, character. And he said that on Star Trek, and because this also dovetails with another question I asked him, which was how much of the Roddenberry philosophy of the future was set at the time of the original series and how much of that evolved over time so that we have it in almost in its full flower in Next Generation. And he had said, no, that a lot of it was there and that he was told by Roddenberry, the way that they set up the casting at Star Trek was you always went with the best actor for a role, that unless it was somehow inherently necessary for the story, the ethnicity, the name, the sex of a character could be changed to match an actor. So that they were always willing to kind of to choose the best person and which is totally in the Star Trek spirit, right? Based on merit and ability and talent, not, skin color and so on. And so I'd asked him what had made you think of Ricardo Montalban. And the thing was that in order to sell this character and in addition to sell the Marla character, to make her seem a little less pathetic, because that is a big problem you can see in all the memos is, how do we write this woman so she's just not, she's supposed to be, Starfleet.
Can I just interrupt right there? Because that's sure. A great point. My wife, when she watched Space Seed, she still feels that Marla comes off as pathetic. So I just thought.
When I've seen that with audiences, even, at screenings or whatever, there's always sort of snickers of like, I oh my gosh, that's the way they thought back in the 60s, that sort of thing.
So go ahead. So
I think that the idea was they needed somebody to make this character, both of these characters, work a little bit. And then that's what made him think of Montalban, a reliable, good actor, handsome, strong, charismatic, all the things that Montalban was. And then there's the flurry of activity very, very late to change this character into who he is. And I think in some ways that's exactly what happened here. The assumption was Benicio del Toro, the paperwork is being drawn up or whatever. And then, 3 weeks before, 4 weeks before they're supposed to film, something happens and he's not playing the role and they need to find somebody. And they find who they think is the best person, even if he doesn't match ethnically. Which by the way, Sulu isn't ethnically the same. I mean, George Takei is not the same ethnicity, I believe, is he, as John Cho?
No.
But there's no battle cry or outcry about the ethnicity change there, right. Which may say something about, people. But I think that there's a lot of parallels. I mean, in some ways I wish that they would release all this stuff about what Space Seed would have looked like and really, let the scripts get out there. I'm trying to get out there, whatever I'm allowed to get out, but it's because in some ways there's so many parallels between the making of this film and the making of Space Seed and just the casting, how, and even how the character is, this Khan is a lot like Harold Erickson, who did kill people in the script and who was maniacal and, you know, devious and in a way that Khan wasn't, which they couldn't be, right? The Montalban's Khan in Space Seed couldn't kill someone if Kirk was going to let him go at the end. Because NBC right. would have never allowed that. They recognized that in the memos, that, it, you know, you have to punish someone who kills someone in the 60s on television. And so Khan could never be what he is in this film, where he's horrible. But that's the way, in some ways, the character was originally conceived.
It's interesting you mentioned, yes, that Khan lets him go at the end of Space Seed and puts him down on SETI Alpha 5. It's interesting, too, at the end of Into Darkness, that they actually put Khan back into cryo freeze as opposed to actually killing him.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of inversions. I mean, when I was first thinking what would they do as a sequel, I thought they were going to invert Wrath of Khan and have Kirk be the one who seeks vengeance against Khan. And in some ways, that's what they did do. But I was thinking more of a literal, they were more clever than I was being in terms of I was thinking. But I think that the way that Khan is presented in Into Darkness, there's so many riffs off of both Space Seed, Wrath of Khan, and you know, good and bad. I can see some people don't like that or did like it, but and then there's even a lot of riffs off of the drafts of Space Seed. I would love to know if those guys looked at those at all, because there's just so many. The Brig sequences, there's a lot of Brig stuff in the original drafts of Space Seed, and of course in this film there's that, you know, the Brig is very important within that story. So it's just, to me, it's very interesting how, you know, I wonder in some ways if stories themselves, you know, there's been some writers talk about the stories already exist in the universe and they just grab them, you know, from out of the air. And I wonder if this is the Space Seed story that's just been there all this time, and they almost grabbed it in the 60s, but they wound up grabbing it for this film.
Well, let's talk about the way that Khan, why he's doing what he's doing, because I really, of course, love Montalban's Khan. I always have. But I also really like Cumberbatch's Khan as well. And they've both been wronged by someone and they want vengeance against that person. But in The Wrath of Khan, Khan has been wronged by Kirk. He blames Kirk for the death of his wife. He blames Kirk for them being stranded on SETI Alpha 5 for so long. And then here, Khan blames Admiral Marcus. And he believes that Marcus has killed, you know, all of his family, all the people who were on the Botany Bay with him. And he's more after vengeance against Marcus and Starfleet in general in Into Darkness, as opposed to just Kirk as an individual, as in The Wrath of Khan. What did you guys make of what I call wronging Khan? You know, these different ways in which Khan has been wronged, either in fact or in perception, in his mind.
I thought it was a good idea, in the sense that you are giving this Khan more dimension than before. And in some ways, it's interesting because, honestly, this Khan's goals are the same as the original Khan. He really does want to take over the universe, basically, because he feels like his superior intellect still requires him to be the leader, and he's not going to settle for less than that. But at the same time, his devotion to his people and the way that he's been woken up and the fact that he's, instead of being found by the benevolent Kirk, who really is benevolent to him, even at the end of Space Seed, he finds the devious Marcus. And, you know, basically, instead of running into God, he's the God-type character, the good guy, he's run into the devil instead and had to make a deal with the devil. And, of course, when you do that, it bites you in the ass. And Marcus really does wrong him. And, you know, it's interesting because in this film, Kirk really doesn't wrong Marcus in any way. I'm sorry, Kirk doesn't wrong Khan in any way in this film. He's just doing his duty and then realizes he's doing the wrong thing. And in fact, more than anything, he would actually probably go out of his way to help Khan if Khan didn't want, you know, galactic domination. It's a much different story, and I really like the fact that they turn that on its head in this film, and that, you know, the Kirk Khan relationship is a lot different. It's just not a replay of what they've done before. So I think the fact that, you know, you gave Khan some more dimension with his own crew, and the way he's been kind of forced to work for Marcus and bide his time and create his own plan of escape and then revenge and wrath against Marcus and Starfleet is very interesting, apart from it being just directed really at Kirk.
Yeah, when I think of Khan, I think you're right. He's always different, you know, in all three of these iterations, he's different. I think the consistency of the character, I don't know if this is intended or it's just me spending too much time with Khan, you know, himself. But I always think of him as maybe not an elasomorph, but sort of a chameleon. So he, what makes him successful as a leader is his ability to adapt to circumstances and, in essence, play off very well off of whoever his opponent is. In other words, he becomes like his opponent in an almost chameleon-like fashion. So Kirk and Khan are very similar to one another, I think, in Space Seed. Their temperament is the same. They're both logicked and reasoned. Kirk's arrogant too, you know, in the original show. It's tempered by his humanity and his decency. But, you know, both of the characters have sort of the same flaws. They both have people who follow them, you know, because of their leadership abilities. I mean, they did do what Kuhn had asked, Gene Kuhn had asked in that memo, which was they did create Kirk's ultimate nemesis in a way, and because they just took Kirk and said, what would, you know, if Kirk was frozen and he woke up in the 29th century, he would be a barbarian too, you know. Maybe he wouldn't do the kind of harmful things that Kirk Khan did, is not his nature, but he would be out of place and out of time. And I think Khan adapts to Kirk, so he becomes able to deal with Kirk by becoming like Kirk. And then in two, you know, you have that same sort of dynamic. Khan now is more of a less the tactician, more the, you know, he's being driven more by madness in two than he was in the first film. The first film he was a tactician, I mean the first in Space Seed. But in two there's a lot of parallels between, you know, Khan and Kirk. They both suffer greatly from hubris, and both of them in essence come to their point of whether they win or lose because of that hubris. And the only reason Kirk wins in a way is first of all, because someone sacrifices themselves, but I think it's lucky. But because Khan has a limitation, you know, and that limitation is the two-dimensional thinking, and Kirk and his crew are more creative. But in many ways, there's a parallel between those characters. And I think in this film, too, especially in the brig, you see Khan becoming like Kirk in the way that he behaves, in his attitude, and in essence is like Marcus, too. So I think that's what's interesting about the character, is he always parallels closely what's going on with the hero of the story, or even in Into Darkness with the bad guy. The main bad guy in the story, but he parallels closely with whoever his opponent is and is able to adapt to that opponent by becoming like that opponent.
Well, and I think I like that idea, because what's so interesting about Into Darkness is really that Kirk is changing at that moment and becoming more like Pike, kind of the man that Pike always knew he could be, the greatness that Pike saw in him is beginning to come out in Kirk as he's listening to people like Spock. He's realizing he should have listened to Scotty. He's realizing he shouldn't be listening to Marcus. He's becoming a man that is learning as I was talking about another podcast recently, the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Kirk has had a lot of knowledge, but he hasn't had a lot of wisdom. And Kirk is quickly in this film learning the difference between those two. And at the same time, Khan is not in this film. Khan is still operating as he has always operated, which is just to try and outthink and outwit and outplay, like he's on Survivor, everybody else. And yet Kirk is really trusting his family that he has. And he's also really beginning to trust what it means to be wise, what it means to be a good leader, what it means to have to sacrifice yourself. And this is where I think the film is brilliant in changing the turnaround that Chris hates so much when they start to do just the Wrath of Khan. But I think it's brilliant because they are changing it for the character of Kirk and actually making Kirk learn the lesson that he never learns in the original series, which is sometimes sacrificing yourself is the only thing you have left. And it's the best decision you can ever make. And yes, he comes back in this film, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But in this film and in this universe, this Kirk actually learns what it means to make the ultimate sacrifice, whereas the other Kirk never learns that lesson until he gets to Generations. And by that time, it's so lame that we don't care.
You know what's interesting? I thought I'd spoken with really the genesis of the ideas with Tony Pascal from over at Trek Movie when we were chatting, but so he deserves really credit for this. But I think in many ways it would have been better. I was fine with it was emotional. I thought, you know, did it diminish Wrath of Khan, or, you know, I'd love to know what Nicholas Meyer thought about it. If he thinks anything about it, I don't know. But if he's seen it and what his opinion is of that and how he feels about that, are you flattered by that, or does that become something else? You know, I would imagine if it was me and I was writing that scene, I would have went to Nicholas Meyer and said, is this okay that we do this, you know? Yeah. And I would imagine maybe they did, you know, they may have. But I thought in some ways that what they should have done is Kirk should have sacrificed, and this is really Tony Pascal, like I said, that Kirk should have sacrificed someone else, because that's really the lesson he needed to learn. Right, because this is one movie, and that scene at the beginning isn't just the Raiders of the Lost Ark fun introduction. That it is setting up themes for the film. The lesson Kirk needs to learn is that you sometimes have to sacrifice someone else as captain. You know, in a way, and I think so. There's two good lessons there. One that Matt talked about, which I think is great, the way they did that. Or the other lesson they could have played it differently, and it could have been that there are sometimes situations where you have to follow the rule, that the Starfleet rule is there for a reason, like Pike was trying to tell him, and McCoy even says he would let you die. I mean, Spock would have followed the rule, and so it's that play and that tug of Kirk, you know, as a rule follower, which he is very much on the original, you know, this whole thing that Kirk loves to break rules is a lot like Kirk is a Lothario. I think those are two misunderstandings of who this character is, shorn up by a few examples of him doing it. And if you see him in a mock time, he really is trying to follow the rules and ultimately doesn't because he has no choice. But did make the right decision because he ultimately gets permission. He was not on the television show going to bed with women left and right. I mean, it's just that isn't true. Yeah. And that's one of that. To me, that's the biggest mistake in this film. When he's in bed with the two women, I'm not talking about, you know, being prudish. To me, because those women are only in that scene for that purpose, it diminishes them. If that scene somehow was meant to show that he was cocky and arrogant and look, he thinks he can take care of, you know, to be with two women at the same time or something, that never comes across. I mean, if that was the purpose of that scene, it was just there to show that he's a Lothario, and that's not who this character is. And that's a fundamental misunderstanding. But I also think that it's a fundamental misunderstanding, you know, in the films, they do that, where he loves to break rules, you know, but that isn't who the character was for 79 episodes. It's who he was for one or two movies.
Right.
And then that just became exaggerated in the way that people think about the character. And I think that would have been nice to see this Kirk maturing by realizing somehow he needs to follow a rule, which means he needs to be willing to sacrifice someone else, not himself. That Scotty should have went in there.
Well, I don't think that Kirk ever, I would never classify him as loving to break the rules. I think that Kirk is okay with breaking rules when it's the necessary thing to do. And Picard is even like that. Picard will violate Starfleet orders if he feels that the orders are wrong and that it's better to take another course of action. So in that sense, you know, Picard, who is viewed as being very much by the book generally, is actually quite similar to Kirk of the original series, who unfortunately, as you say, John, is viewed as being like a Wild West cowboy who just loves to break the rules, which really isn't the case. But Matthew, I mean, I agree with you. Actually, this is the thing. When you explain this movie the way you do, Matthew, every time we talk about it, I agree completely with what you say about Kirk. Where it breaks down for me is that I don't think that the correct way to convey that message to the audience is to replay the end of The Wrath of Khan, especially not to Star Trek fans, because you're unnecessarily pissing off the fans and you're pulling them out of the story and they're just focusing on the fact that you are stealing material, both visually and exact lines, from what is generally regarded as the best Star Trek movie and scenes that are so iconic. And you don't need to do it. And it actually, I think, weakens the message. And just to bring this back around to Khan, I said earlier that I really enjoy Into Darkness for about 2/3 of the movie. I'm really into it. And I think the story is really interesting. And I like the character of Khan. And John, you were talking about the brig scene and how Khan reacts in the brig. And I like Cumberbatch's performance there. I like the angle that he's bringing to Khan. And it's interesting because this is a Khan who seems to be, now he may be acting again because he's calculating all the time, but he at least portrays it as he's a man who is really hurt. He's really been injured inside by Marcus and how he feels he's been mistreated by Marcus and Starfleet. And so at least they try to make you as the audience feel that Khan is justified in his actions. And I don't feel, when I watch The Wrath of Khan, I never really sympathize with that Khan. I never really feel that he's justified in his actions and his vengeance against Kirk, because as we discussed earlier here, you know, Kirk really was benevolent towards Khan at the end of Space Seed. Even MacGyver's, I mean, he let one of his officers who betrayed the crew and allowed Khan to try to take over the ship to go. She wasn't court-martialed. She wasn't really punished. And Kirk didn't know that City Alpha 6 was going to explode and that City Alpha 5 was going to become uninhabitable. So Khan is blaming Kirk for not coming back to check on him, pretty much. And then Marla dies, and so he's upset about that. But the way that Khan is written in Into Darkness is stronger for me in terms of, can I at least try, whether I agree or not with what the character is doing, can I try to see why in his mind he might be justified in his actions? And so it's really working for me all the way up until that point. And what bothers me the most about the end of the movie, again, Matthew, I know you know, because we talk about it often, how much I don't like the end of this movie, and I don't like the whole engine room bit. What bothers me most about it is I feel like they forgot about Khan. They forgot about the depth they were giving to the character. And after Khan goes to the Vengeance, after he kills Marcus, after he beams Kirk and Carol and everyone back over to the Enterprise, then he just becomes the madman. And they just kind of abandon the character. And from that point on, all we really get of the character is the video game hero with the fights on the flying ships over San Francisco, which was stolen from Star Wars Episode 3. And that's it. And it's like, I wanted to know more. I wanted to continue this development of Khan. I wanted it to play out. And John, I like Tony's idea of Kirk sacrificing someone else, because that would have helped me feel like Kirk was learning something at the end, because the whole thing with the Tribble and the super blood was ridiculous. First of all, it's transparently set up at the beginning of the film. And then, in case you forgot what was going on at the beginning of the film, they have that ridiculous scene where Kirk is in a conversation with Khan, and then he stops a conversation with Khan during a critical situation to ask Bones, "What are you doing with that Tribble?" And then he goes back into the conversation. So it's like someone threw a car into reverse for a second, or yanked the emergency brake, and then they set up the Deus Ex Machina for the end of the movie, and then they go back into the narrative again. And it just, for me, it's bad writing, and it didn't work. And I wish that they had continued to develop Khan through to the end of the movie. And then if Kirk did have to sacrifice someone else, and that person actually really did die, as Spock did at the end of The Wrath of Khan, even though they brought him back later, at the end of that movie, let's just talk about that movie, Spock's dead. And it would have been such a stronger finish. And it would have completed the development of this version of Khan for me.
You know, Chris, I mean, I see some of that, but I also think that this is where the idea of just kind of that wrath of Khan comes out, that by the end of the film, you've gotten to the core of who he is, which is just this person who, if I can't rule, then I will destroy what, or at least I will try to destroy everything else. And that kind of madman mentality, which, you know, you kind of get into Cot at the end of the series of Deep Space Nine, and yeah, that megalomaniac problem, which all really good villains end up becoming megalomaniacs, unless they're, you know, I guess like Darth Vader, where, you know, they're redeemable. But at the same time, you know, you have on the other side the Emperor, who is nothing but a megalomaniac. So, you know, and he makes a great villain. So, you know, you, for those who don't know the Star Wars references, but
well, Darth Vader, I mean, that's the thing there, that actually Anakin becomes that at the end, and he really does meet his end. And then he becomes Darth Vader, but he's mostly a machine, right, at that point. So he only becomes redeemable because he actually becomes a different person.
Right. You know, and so, you know, I didn't have as much of a problem with the end of this film. You know, I wish there had been more barrel rolls. you know, I feel like that there could have been some great barrel rolls on that.
The ship did barrel rolls,
too.
The ship did barrel rolls.
Yeah, that's true. The ship was actually, yeah, you're right. I forgot about that part. But, I did like in the end that you kind of gotten down to the core of the evilness of who Khan was, of, you know, he was willing to destroy San Francisco, Starfleet Academy, Starfleet headquarters. He didn't care how many people died. He doesn't care about anything but himself and his own ambition and rule. And in the end is very much the same as Maltaban's Khan, but at the same time, there was all that other development that you had given him before. So you saw that there was a lot more to him than just this, but at the core of his being, this was who he is. And I think, like you were saying, I would have rather have seen more of that development for the Khan in The Wrath of Khan, because I would have felt more scared of him. I would have felt like he was an even better villain than he is. His motivations would have been better, all that kind of stuff. So I don't, yeah, I can see part of what you're saying, but at the same time, I felt like I had gotten so much development at that point, you know, you have to end the film. And so
yeah.
I didn't get as much as to where you were. So
do you think, John, that what Matthew's saying in terms of where this Khan ends up at the very end of the film and in terms of being evil at the core and all, is that true to the original concept of Khan for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to me, the really understanding that character and understanding that the the morphing, the chameleon, the manipulation he does of people, because he's able to read them so well and then becomes like them. So I think the classic example of that, you know, in the original show is, you know, the dinner sequence where they're sitting around in Space Seed, you know, talking to one another. And it is like Kirk talking to a mirror version of himself. And then you get that in this film where he's on the Vengeance, and he's dealing with Spock, right? He's dealing with Kirk primarily, and was a lot like Kirk, appealing to what you would do for your family, for your crew, all of that, which gets it right at the heart of who Kirk is as a character. But then with Spock, he starts appealing to, well, let's address this logically. And so he's really good at becoming that other person. And then what's interesting is when he's left alone in Wrath of Khan, he takes the "I'm going to destroy everything and everyone" path. Whereas until that moment when he's alone, he's willing to, you know, he's willing to strand Kirk, right? Let him suffer. And he doesn't have to destroy everything. But when he's alone, when his crew is killed and he's by himself, then he wants to destroy everything. And I think you get the same thing in this film, which makes Matt's analysis, I think, really on point and, you know, exactly right for that character. Because when he's by himself now and there is no crew, at least he thinks there's no crew anymore, then he really wants to destroy everything. And I thought, you know, that, of course, reinforces the 9/11 parallels when the ship is crashing into those buildings. You know, I wish they would have done it a little less like, hey, it's a fun special effect, and a little more like, hey, there are millions of people being killed here, and this is horrible. You know, I wish they would have been treated a little less remotely. It's a little too remote for me. The way that they do it, it's just kind of like a cool action scene, and it really isn't cool. It's horrible at its core of what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But I really do think that that character is like that. I think that is the essence of who the character is. He is a destroyer when his back is against the wall, and you see that in Wrath of Khan, and I think you see that in this film too.
Well, let's wrap up with one last topic, and it goes back to something that was mentioned at the very beginning. Well, actually, maybe midway through, when you were talking about whether Nicholas Meyer would approve of, you know, the scenes that they took from The Wrath of Khan and such. But two things, actually. Okay, one of them was, and I was surprised to hear this, but on the commentary track for Into Darkness, in the section where we get to where they're doing the engine room scene, at that point, the people who are on the commentary track are Damon Lindelof and Brian Burke, because on this commentary track, they keep bringing new people in throughout to talk about different aspects of producing the movie. It's not your traditional commentary track where it's just the same group of people all the way through. So they get to this, and it comes on, and Lindelof says, "Now, this is actually kind of cool." And then he says, "If you liked the movie, you understand that this is sort of our homage, our version, our love letter to Wrath of Khan." And when he said love letter, I immediately thought of These Are the Voyages, and remember what happened last time someone tried to do a love letter to Star Trek and how that was received. But one question I wanted to ask you guys. Do you guys agree that that was a love letter to the Wrath of Khan, or was it just maybe a creative mistake that should have been handled differently because they just thought it would be kind of cute to replay the Wrath of Khan?
Well, I think I would say you really do have fans writing these films, which maybe that shows you know, the good and the bad of that. You know, the when you had Nicholas Meyer writing, you had someone who wasn't a fan, but who understood the heart of these characters, their relationships with one another. I mean, eventually I would presume he did have affection for these characters, even if he came in not being, you know, more aware of Star Trek than the general populace would have been, you know, where he wasn't, you know, chapter and verse on it. So you get that aspect of it. And then you get something like Nemesis, which is written by a fan. And in many ways, there's a lot about Nemesis to admire. I mean, certainly the characters speak in authentic voices in that film, you know, for the most part. I mean, people may not like the situations or the story or what happens to Data or whatever, but the, you know, the characters certainly sound like themselves, and in a way that they may not have in some of the previous films. Certainly for First Contact, which a lot of people like, I don't. I don't think it's a very good Star Trek film. It's a great zombie movie, but, you know, Picard is not Picard. As the heart of the character is different in that film. But, I think that there you do have fans writing this movie, and as fans, they may get carried away sometimes, with some of the references. Others are wonderful, the miracle worker line, you know, just little things like that, those little seeds that wouldn't be in there probably if these guys weren't fans, the authentic sounds of the way these characters are. But a manifestation of that might be this desire to, you know, to do what we all wish, I think, when we were, you know, we either relived Wrath of Khan through action figures and toys when we were younger, or, you know, created, you know, a painting based on that scene. I mean, it is a sort of, you know, the defining scene of any Star Trek film, and just a wonderful, I mean, Wrath of Khan, that death scene is just a wonderful scene. I still get choked up. I've seen it 2 million times, and I still care when Spock dies.
Yeah, yes, same for me this weekend, in fact.
And so, if you are gonna do that, you have to do it with respect. Forget the argument of should they do it. If you're gonna do it, you need to do it with respect. You need to do it in a way that. You know, isn't a mockery, and I would say that wasn't. I mean, I don't think that scene in Into Darkness is at all a mockery. It isn't meant to cheapen. I think we can debate whether it should be there or not. But I don't think that they did it in a way that was sort of like disrespectful in any way. You know, it's
no, I don't think that
to Wrath of Khan. But yeah. I didn't see it as a love letter. I saw it as, you know, an inversion, the continued inversion that the give us a little bit, show us how this universe is the same, show us how it's different. Now, do you get down to the lines of dialogue? You know, I don't know if you want to get down to that level of nitty gritty. And I don't think they needed to in that scene. I don't think there was no need necessarily to do that, but because I do think it took you out of the film.
Exactly. That's my problem.
Now, if you weren't a fan, I mean, I'd be interested, your wife watched it. Did she, not having seen Wrath of Khan, did she like that scene? In other words, did it work for her in Into Darkness, do you know? Or?
It was okay. I mean, obviously, she wasn't colored by the experience of already knowing that scene from the Wrath of Khan. But basically, for her, when we left the theater, I said, what did you think of the movie? And she said, well, it's a really fun action movie, but it lacks depth. And that was her response. And I thought it was interesting to hear that from someone who, you know, isn't a diehard Trekkie. And again, she didn't mean it lacked depth in the fact that there's no depth in the movie at all. What she actually meant by it was the same thing that I'm saying, which is that they actually set the characters up and they had very interesting storylines going, but they didn't follow through enough on them. And so you kind of left feeling like there was a lot left on the table.
That's where that 10 minutes would have, I don't know what the fear would be to go to 2.5 hours on a Star Trek film. I think you can go to 2.5 hours on a Star Trek film. Cause I certainly didn't want the movie to end. You know, it was like, you know, for me, like Lone Ranger, regardless of whether people thought it was a good movie or not, it didn't feel like 2.5 hours. The Avengers didn't feel like 2.5 hours. And I think if you do these films well, and no pacing and stuff, which these guys definitely do, you can go 2.5 hours. It certainly did not hurt Man of Steel's box office to be 2.5 hours. And, you know, so you can do well with 2.5 hours. And I think they shouldn't be afraid to make Star Trek a little more epic and get into, add those moments and have all that action at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they talk about the idea of love letter to fans, on a whole, if this is how you're going to write a love letter, it's definitely much better than These Are the Voyages, which is just a complete catastrophe in every sense of the word. There's nothing really redeemable about that episode. except for the fact that maybe, you know, we have Shran in it.
Well, I like the very ending. I like Archer and T'Pol's relationship coming to full, you know, from where they started. Where
I guess,
ended,
I guess that might be the only thing redeemable in there, except that it comes at the expense of a stupid death. And so true. That is worthy of Joss Wheaton's stupidity when it comes to some deaths. And so I don't understand, you know, the vitriol from fans. I think that where they used Into Darkness and The Wrath of Khan together, the inversion worked enough for me that I wasn't pulled out so much, even when they were using lines. The only line for me that pulls me out is when Spock yells Khan, and the only reason is because of Quinto's performance there. It had nothing to do with the fact that he was screaming that name, which I thought was totally justified at that point when he thinks that Khan has just killed his best friend, and so why wouldn't you be screaming the name of the man who just killed your best friend? So I don't have a problem with that. I just really had a problem with the way that Quinto, who I don't really love as Spock, I mean, he's fine, he's just not my favorite. His delivery of that line is so lame that that pulls me out. Not the fact that they used the line at all.
Just using that line was a good way to do, I mean, this is almost what Chris was saying before. You do lose Khan for part of that film, you know, when they're sort of, when they do the whole Enterprise Titanic sequences. And, it was a good way to bring you back in and sort of be like, oh crap, you know, there's still this other threat that's out there. Whether that works or not as a performance is a separate issue, but the placement of that in the film at that point, and then the way it was edited into the film, was a good way, I think.
It was good.
It just needed, you know, you didn't want you, it was the Darth Vader no problem. There was nothing wrong with the no, it was the delivery of the no.
Yeah, maybe. That's a valid argument, although I feel that that line is so iconic in cinema that it should not have been used. I felt it was inappropriate to be used at that point, but that's for another debate when we actually debate the entire movie itself. But the last thing, just to close out, the final topic, and this again comes from the commentary, and I just want your thoughts on this. Lindelof, in justifying why they used Khan, he says, we felt like we couldn't avoid Khan. And then I'm going to paraphrase. He says, so we just do it and free our franchise of the only question that was plaguing it. Now the next movie and those moving forward can tell new stories, but first we had to address Khan. And again, that's not an exact quote. I'm paraphrasing his quotes a little bit longer. I don't know. Do you believe that? Do you feel like they had to do Khan in order to somehow move forward with the reboot of Star Trek? Because I don't buy that at all. I think it's complete BS.
I think it's, I mean, I do think people would have been wondering, would they be, when are they using Khan in the way they would have been wondered, when are you using the Borg, you know? I don't think that's a justifiable reason, though. I mean, I don't expect the Star Trek films to be the television show, in the sense that they can't do what they do on the television show. Star Trek really belongs on TV. That's where it should be. It needs to be there. I hope it comes back to there. And it would be interesting to see it done in the way television is today and the environment that it is today. But that being said, I'd like to see a Star Trek film that, you know, has that exploratory, you know, this Earth in danger is just, it's enough, stop. Mm-hmm. It needs to go away. It's been done in the Star Trek world so many times. And, you know, it was done in four in a really imaginative way by having the villain, in essence, be us today, you know, and how we treat whales, and that we are the villain in a way. And so, but I think that's not a reason to use to do it. I mean, you don't want to say this film was just there so we can get it out there, throw it out, and move on. I mean, hopefully, you know, that wasn't the attitude. I would assume it wasn't the attitude towards this film by them.
Think it was that. But
I don't think
presenting
it was at all.
It like it was something that they had to do so that they could then move forward. And I think you're right that fans would be wondering, like, are you going to do Khan or when are you going to use Khan? But I don't think that there was any great universal force driving that the second movie has to be Khan, because until we can't tell an original story.
I think people presumed at the end of the last film that we were going to get an original, that the horse was out of the gate at that point. I don't think you didn't necessarily need to do a second in the gate story, you know, where Kirk, even in the sense of Kirk, I mean, I felt in some ways at the end of the last film, although maybe they were more honest in this film, that he did get promoted too quickly and it was a little bit too easy
and he wasn't ready.
And that was good, you know, but in some ways it seems like, well, then this film is addressing the criticism of that. So now is the third film going to address the criticism of this film by being, I mean, you don't want to make films based on, reactionary, you know, it shouldn't be a comment section to the previous film. I mean, it should be its own thing. And it seems like this one, they may have gone in that direction of like, well, we need to address this fact that Kirk was put in the chair too early. But it was done well, I thought. And then,
I think so.
So the next film now, you know, they really do need to be original. There should be no characters, you know, from the original show, except, you know, if they did Rand or somebody like that, you could do that, you know. But they shouldn't be bringing in, you know, George Takei or anything. And at least as Sulu, they could bring him in to play an alien or something. But, you know, it needs to be its own thing. And I'd love it to be a threat of a scientific nature or a threat of an alien planet where we kind of learn about this other culture a little bit. In some ways, I would have loved to have seen the first 15 minutes as a film. That would have been a very interesting movie, you know, if they really had done that 15 minutes and learned about that culture on the planet and who these people were. And, you know,
that's the other thing my wife said afterwards was, what happened to the aliens at the beginning of the movie? Because again, like, I mean, she understands that's just there to set up the whole fact that Kirk violated the Prime Directive and got in trouble for that. But that's an interesting point, right? What happens when you reveal these things to a civilization who, as Pike said, has barely invented the wheel? Where does that lead? That's the kind of stuff I think Star Trek fans really want to delve into.
You know, I don't think, and I was thinking about this while you guys were talking, and, you know, do they have to do Khan? I think that in some ways Khan kind of does loom over the series always, even when you reboot it. You know, when will you redo it? Will you redo it? How will you redo it? You know, when's he going to show up? Because everybody just kind of, I mean, that's the character that everybody knows. That's the villain, you know, aside from the Borg or Q, that everybody knows from, you know, Star Trek or Star Trek The Next Generation. And so you do kind of wonder when that's going to happen. And I could see them wanting to try and tell that story as good as they possibly could so that they didn't have to worry about it later on. And, you know, if Paramount was smart, you would think they would be wanting to do 3, 4, 5 of these Star Trek films. I mean, you know, you would want to be trying to get as much out of this as possible. I mean, you really have the open-ended ability to be able to do that as the studio, and you're making decent money on them, so why not?
And you have young actors as well.
And you do, exactly. You have very young actors who can really grow into these roles, they all seem to enjoy doing the films, and so, you know, if you treat them well, they'll continue to come back. So I can understand the writers wanting to get rid of this problem, or perceived problem, even for them, to just get it out of the way so they really could be free. Because when you think about Star Trek and the original series, you immediately think of Space Seed, and you do think of the Wrath of Khan. And so I can really understand them wanting to address this so that they can do whatever it is they'd like to do next. Because now, when it comes to the original series, they really are free to create any story they'd like. And you wouldn't feel cheapened, obviously. Nobody cares if they're going to go visit Shaka Ree or, you know, anything like that. You know, nobody wants to see a rehash of Star Trek 4. You know, nobody I mean, you can't really do Star Trek VI. So none of that really applies. And now you really have opened the door for something. And so as a writer, I can completely understand where Lindelof is coming from. It makes sense to me. I think that they did the best possible job that they could in a lot of ways with this, Connor. There's some things that I would have even liked to have changed. Yeah, you know, there's some things I would have. But on a whole, I really enjoy Star Trek Into Darkness. I enjoy what they do with Khan. I think most of it is very smart. I think there are some dumb mistakes. But hey, you know, every single film pretty much these days, unless it's a great, you know, indie drama, has problems that it, you know, it's just kind of the way that, you know, big blockbusters go. There's always some things that you don't like that you thought could be done better. And
Well, I think that's the problem with blockbusters and trying to make blockbusters.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for me too. I mean, I enjoy the movie. And of course, our primary topic today is Khan. And to that end, the issues that I have with Star Trek Into Darkness don't involve Khan. As a character, Khan, I like what they did with him. I have no problem with them bringing him back. I think that they did create a character, as you put very well, Matthew, and John, you also agreed with Matthew on this, is true to Khan at the core of who Khan is, but is different enough that you can watch it and you're not thinking all the time about Khan from the Wrath of Khan or Spacey. There's just this other interesting character, and I just wish that they had followed through with him a little bit more. But as far as the character himself goes, I think they did a nice job, and I really enjoyed it. Well, it's been a fascinating conversation today. So before we go, John...
A conversation.
And John, we really appreciate you taking a lot of your evening out here to talk with us about Khan. You know, this is a show we were planning to do for a long time with you. But I, of course, had to wait until I could see Into Darkness. And then I wanted to see it a second time when it actually opened in the theaters here so I could kind of confirm.
How is the perception there among the fans or the critics? Or
I don't really know. You know, Star Trek is not really a thing here. And the first JJ movie only made $5 million in Japan. And this one, I don't know yet what the box office is. I doubt it will do a whole lot better because they waited so long to release it that if you were really looking forward to the movie here, well, you would have already known, you know, what was going on. So I think Paramount made a marketing blunder in the way they handled Japan this time, but we'll see what the box office reflects and find out how it did. So I don't know. The theater, I went to see it. Of course, we went to see it in the middle of the week during the daytime. We went to the IMAX showing, and the theater was about 80% empty. So, and that was only a few days after it opened. It opened on Friday, and we saw it on Tuesday. So we'll see how it goes in Japan. Well, John, tell everyone where they can find you if they would like to, you know, follow along more of the things that you're doing around the internets.
Well, best way to get me is just at Twitter at JTenuto, and that's JTENUTO. And if you live in Northern Illinois and are free, if you check the Aspen Library, it's part of the Cook Memorial Library, but it would actually be in Vernon Hills, Illinois, the Aspen Library. We have a couple of talks coming up. One is about the contributions of Italians and Italian Americans to society, and not much Star Trek in that. But we are in September doing a Wrath of Khan talk. My wife and I were going to show about 200 behind-the-scenes photos from Wrath of Khan and really celebrate all the wonderful artists, from Nicholas Meyer to Gayne Rescher and Craig Denault and all just the camera people, the special effects technicians, everyone who made Wrath of Khan really interesting, and talk a little bit about Into Darkness and so on and Space Seed in that talk as well. So that'd be great if anybody's listening who wants to go. It's a free talk. And we're also writing the research for Space Seed. We were asked by StarTrek.com to start sharing that. So we just wrote the fourth installment, I think, and that should be up in the next couple of days at StarTrek.com, where we're really going into super detail, like we did on your show, into the making of Spacey, because I really want people to have this information and share this information with fans.
That's cool that they have you doing that. We've talked before about how we really wish that they would commission you guys to write an actual book, you know, dedicated book about Spacey and the Wrath of Khan, but at least maybe this is the first step toward that.
Yeah, be great. I mean, these pictures really need, I don't know what the permissions are and all of that they would need to go through, but it's, the pictures are amazing and really tell a great story about, you know, what it took to make this film and how important this film is, I think, to certainly to the Star Trek franchise, and also to the culture. I mean, you know, it opened, I always like to remind people that Star Trek II opened as the number one box office film of all time, including beating Empire Strikes Back. And it really resonated with the culture. We had asked my mother, when we took her to see the film, you know, do you remember the name of Ricardo Montalban's bad guy in Star Trek? And she said, Khan, of course. And it was like, you know, that's what that film did, you know, for the culture, you know, gave us this really great character. So I love sharing stuff about it.
Awesome. That sounds great. So thanks so much again for joining us today, John. It's always great to have you on the shows with us.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. Chris, that was fantastic. Every time that we talk to John, I feel like I learned something new about Khan, and I'm so glad that he was able to join us in talking about kind of contrasting the characters between this Khan and Montalban's Khan. I feel like in the end, they weren't really conning anyone into whether or not it was going to be Khan in Into Darkness, but it was a great discussion with John, as it always is, and so I'm not sure how many con metaphors here I can use or puns. Chris, save me.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I don't think we need any more con puns in here, for sure, but no, I agree. You know, you and I talked about this way back when, you know, we knew it was Khan in the movie before it was really known that it was Khan in the movie, and we said we want to at some point have this discussion with John about Khan after we've seen the film. And of course, we could sit down anytime. We could just talk about Khan and what we think about it. But I felt it was really important to have John on with us to do this because he's able to talk about Khan in a way that transcends just simple fandom because he has done so much in-depth research on the character and the history of the character and knows a lot of things that really no one knows because, as he mentioned, he's trying to get this information out there as much as he's allowed to reveal, but he knows a lot of stuff that just hasn't been revealed yet still. So I'm glad he could join us today. And I really enjoyed talking about this character because, you know, as people know, as you know, as listeners know, people who follow me on Twitter, I am really mixed about Star Trek Into Darkness. And while so much of the controversy about the movie surrounds the fact that Khan is in the film, Khan is not the reason that I have issues with the film. I really enjoy Khan in this film. So I'm glad we did this. But, you know, this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing this week on Trek FM. We've been talking about all sorts of other things. So here are a few other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Great Sisko episodes.
I was definitely channeling Sisko, but it's a great episode to watch that passion come out of him, that he is a passionate captain, you know, and man.
The Ready Room.
The Devil in the Dark.
Wouldn't there be a point, if they can go through rocks so easily, that they would have depleted that entire planet of its resources in the last 50,000 years?
Deck 8.
Voyager STO.
Well, Voyager's pretty much the only series that hasn't had much content.
Oh, yeah, think about it. You've got loads from the original series, loads from the Next Generation, and you've got pretty much all of the main ones from Deep Space Nine, apart from the Vorta.
To the journey!
Kes.
Kind of like the reverse of a kangaroo. It's like this pouch on her back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That would be kind of unusual. It would be the most unusual maternity uniform ever.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
What dreams may come.
It's kind of like 1984. And just like in 1984, like, that guided tour is more interesting than most books that have an extremely compelling story.
Warp 5.
The Augments Arc.
You know, and as you say, all of this was about, from his perspective, trying to improve humanity and thinking he was doing the right thing, and he was not prepared to do absolutely anything for it. He wasn't prepared to kill another human being.
Trek News and Views.
A Taste of Armageddon.
So basically, some scientist goes to command and said, look, I've developed this new weapon. No, you can't do that. It's not in the rules.
Literary Treks.
Mission's End.
The question is, do you feel like Section 31 is overused? Everyone wants to use Section 31, and so they just keep popping up in every story, and I think sometimes it does a disservice to the idea of Section 31.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all these shows and get your Trek Talk fix every day of the week. Some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in iTunes, on TuneIn, Stitcher, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can stream from the website, download files from the website. Many ways for you to get our shows, so check them all out and enjoy discussion on a wide range of Star Trek topics every single day. Now, Matthew, I know our listeners must have thoughts on what we talked about today on Khan. So if you would like to share those thoughts with us, here's how to do it. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail by clicking on the tab on the right-hand side of any page on the site. A box will appear. You can use your webcam's microphone to record a message, and then you can upload it to us as an MP3 file. You can also start a conversation about Khan on our forums and talk to other listeners and the Trek FM crew. Just go to trek.fm/forums to do that. And in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username TrekFM. Now, Matthew, why do people want to just talk to you directly about Khan or anything else Star Trek or other topics? Where should they go?
Well, if you'd like to do that, you can check me out on Twitter. MattRushing02 is the place to go. Talk about all sorts of things there. I'm getting back into tweeting a little bit more than I have this very busy summer. And so, of course, lots of great things coming up. Movie-wise this year, the next Hobbit film, things I'll be talking about. So I'm really excited about that. Chris, you know how much I love The Hobbit.
I'm going on an adventure!
And then, of course, you can find me at my own blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. I write about all sorts of things there. Other types of book reviews. I do the Star Trek book reviews for Trek FM, but I also do, and I read other types of books as well. So movie reviews there, things like that. And then, of course, Chris, we also do a few shows together. We do Literary Treks, where we talk about the books and comics of the Star Trek literary universe, as well as doing The Orb together, where we talk about Deep Space Nine all the time. So if you're a huge Niner, you want to hear more about something like Section 31, just check us out on The Orb. We would love to have you. And in fact, too, we just want to say thank you to everybody as well who just writes us iTunes reviews on any of our shows here at Trek FM. We really appreciate it. It helps us get more listeners. So any of the shows, we just like to say thank you for doing that for us. It's a big deal for us. And in your words of encouragement when you give us the reviews mean a lot. And so we just want to say thank you. Now, Chris, when you're not conning other people, where can they find you?
You had to slip one more in there, didn't you?
It had to be done. It's part of the Literary Treks drinking game. So you'll find more about that on Literary Treks. But yeah.
Yeah, well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. You'll also find me on my personal website at cbrianjones.com, where I also talk about other things besides Star Trek. Although there's a little bit of Trek stuff there as well that's not on Trek FM, so check that out. And besides the shows that we do together, Matthew, you'll also find me on Fridays with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk about Enterprise. So check that out as well if you'd like. Also, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsors for this week's show. Your support of our sponsors is very important to making it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, a website, a portfolio, an online store. Pretty much anything you want to build online, you can do it very easily with Squarespace. So create your own space today. go to squarespace.com and get your free 14-day trial. There's no credit card required. And then when you sign up, use offer code TREK9 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And choose that annual plan and get that free custom domain registration as well. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and The Ready Room. Also, if you love Star Trek, go over to trekfan.org and join this group. It's not just your typical fan club. It's a great chance for you to collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives. And you can also win great prizes, and you'll be helping move the world towards that Star Trek future. So jump into action, go to trekfan.org, support them and support The Ready Room, solve your first puzzle, and take the next step on your adventure. And we thank Trek Fan for their support of Trek FM and The Ready Room as well. And lastly, if you'd personally like to support what we're doing here at Trek FM, you can go to trek.fm/donate. We have 8 alien-themed badges and art prints for you to choose from. They're original illustration by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And you can mix and match badges and art prints. Choose which ones you want. There are different levels of contributions that you can make. And your donations help us cover the cost of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring The Ready Room to you every week. So please support us. Go over to trek.fm/donate, get your alien badges, and we'd really appreciate your support of The Ready Room and Trek FM. Well, Matthew, I'm going to head out. You know, I've been sitting at this desk for way too long. I need to get some exercise, so I think I'm going to go do a space jump with Khan, because that looks really exciting.
Chris, that sounds like a good idea. Don't forget to wear a helmet, because there's no fresh air in space. But, you know, it's time to stick a lost shower scene in it, because The Ready Room is done. Recording, Paramount Stupid Pants.
Actually, in this case, Khan is missing his pants because they're on the Target disc.
Oh.
And Khan bought the Best Buy disc.
Wait, is that where they added that extra scene where he's taking a shower?
Yes.
Okay. That's the only place you get to see it is the Target exclusive. Watch Khan take a shower.
Apparently, that scene was their homage to the shower scene that was cut from The Wrath of Khan.
Really? Yes,
that would have been great.
Was that the shower scene where Kirk and Spock were together? Oh, wait, that's a whole different show.
Oh, goodness.
Then about the steady eel and coming out of your ear.
Oh, gosh.
When he cleaned his ears in the shower, it came out. That's how it was originally going to come out. It wasn't Kirk.
But what happened is that when they built that giant ear on a board, they couldn't waterproof it, and so they had to change and rewrite the shower scene.
Which works, you know, it's just Star Trek's commitment to science, right? Because when you're in a shower, your wax loosens up when you're in there and everything. That's what would have happened. The eel would have just...
Yeah, just slid right
out.
No
one could take
a
shower on SETI Alpha 5, right? That's why the eel never came out of them, because no one...
Exactly. That's right. Oh, man. Whew. I'm glad that we have finally solved this mystery.
We have figured this out.
Yeah. Wow.
You won't get that on any extras.
That's right.
Definitely not.
Nope.